TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Unveiling the Paradox, Extracting Non-Renewable Riches for a Sustainable Tomorrow. Simon Michaud worked for 18 years in the mining industry in Australia in research and development. He has a PhD in mining, engineering, and explosives. In 2015, he came to Europe to learn industrial recycling and the circular economy at the University of Leiden, Netherlands. Michaud's now associate professor, GTK, the Geological Survey of Finland. On his website at GTK, he says, "If we want to transition away from fossil fuels, mining of minerals and using recycled minerals and metals from industrial waste streams in new ways will have to increase greatly." He was interviewed by Tony from Sustainable Logistics on April 7, 2024.
At the moment, wind and solar are not viable as the primary power systems to replace fossil fuels. And what's driving that is the need for the power buffer and the size of that power buffer. So we're on the right path in context of we understand that fossil fuels are going and we've got to get rid of them. That in its own right was quite a paradigm shift. The plan to actually sort of be renewable by 2030 or 2050, these are all being based on ideology. Politicians saying we will do this without understanding how to do that. Every single plan I've seen for the phasing out of fossil fuels, especially by 2030 or 2050, in my opinion, is delusional because they haven't actually looked at the practicalities. There's no feasibility plan for industrial reform that I have seen that actually gets to the point where it discusses, right, we will now have this amount of installed power in these regions that's not fossil fuel. And this is the infrastructure we need to do that. So far, they're saying, oh, they'll talk in terms of percentages. We'll be 80% renewable. The people who make those statements are not talking to people who actually will work out the logistics involved with that to the point where they're responsible for the outcome. They're making stuff up. They're pulling numbers out of the air. Ideology is fine in its own right, but what we must do is the next step is to check it out, run some numbers and check them against reality. That step has not been done yet.
That's unbelievable. Well, why haven't we done it?
Because we haven't had to. For the last 100 years, energy's been abundant, money's been abundant, and natural resources have all been abundant. And if we want stuff, we can just make it up. But we haven't had to balance our budgets at a nation state level for 50 years. We want more money, we just print more money. And every nation state around the world is doing that. So that thinking and the phrase, the market will fix it. We're abdicating responsibility, planning for the future by making such statements. That's how we've operated. So we've never had to think in these terms before, therefore we don't. Looking at the green transition, if we were to go off and phase out fossil fuels, what would that look like and what's required? So for the last 5 years, I've looked at that specifically. If we were to phase out fossil fuels, no more chit-chat, we're now going to do it. And if I assembled all the non-fossil fuel systems I could get for the time, and I mapped the calendar year of 2018 to actually do this. And so I worked out how much of physical units that we would actually need and how we'll be using them. What I have found is the task of, like, we're still hopelessly dependent on fossil fuels. All the work that we've done to bring in renewable technology for the last 10, 15 years is actually less in capacity than the expansion of the fossil fuel systems under it. So we have yet to actually phase out anything. We're using more oil, gas, and coal than ever. Right. So the task is much larger than we thought. Now, it's going to take time to produce all these things. So there's time, there's money, who's going to pay for all this? Then there is where the things get constructed, like most of it, our manufacturing happens in Southeast Asia, China in particular, not in Europe. Do they have the capacity to produce such a large number of renewable technology units? The answer is no. We want so many things, and we have set ourselves a target to do all this by 2050. the IEA says, you know, by 2050, we're pretty much there. Right, so that's 26 years away. And so we don't have a lot of time. Then the question became, well, where do we get the raw materials from? Now, I'm part of the Circular Economy Solutions Unit, and so recycling is considered very important. In fact, we would like to get most of our raw materials from recycling if we could. That's a can of worms. As it turns out, that's not going to happen for two reasons that have nothing to do with recycling technology. One, we're not designing things to be recycled, which means it's very, very hard to get anything, the efficient recycling out. And two, our society is not geared for the collection of waste streams where things can be recycled efficiently. For example, most mobile phones, like, you know, here's my mobile phone. Most mobile phones, when they wear out, they're not actually sort of handed in for recycling. People put them in a drawer. 95% of mobile phones that are old and out of use now are in a drawer somewhere. All right, so recycling, while will be strategically important, the amounts of metals we need is huge, much more than recycling can actually deliver. The other problem is the metals that we want are relatively exotic, like lithium and cobalt and vanadium and what have you. And we do mine these things now, but not in quantities like this. So there's not enough metals, exotic metals, in the system now that can be recycled. So this is a mining story. For at least the first generation of technology, at least, is mining. And the next piece of work was to look at the volume of metal we would need to replace things, like 100% replacement, which will be done in the next 26 years, apparently, right? And put that up against the mining industry's ability to deliver that. And what I found is existing mining production will not be able to meet that demand. And so now we've got to have the idea of open more mines. Can we open more mines? Well, yes, but it takes between 15 and 20 years to open a mine. Even with the deposit we know is there and everything's right, this is what the incubation cycle is. So that's not going to be easy. So then we go, so, well, is there enough mineral reserves? And turns out, no, not even close. Now, a mineral reserve is a patch of mineralized rock in the ground that's economically feasible to extract. We've actually looked at it and said, yes, this is viable. We can do it. A mineral resource is a patch of ground that's got mineralization that's slightly above background mineralization. But we don't know what's in it yet. We don't really know much about it. And it could be minerals that are too deep for us to mine, or it could be such low grade, or the metal is so small that it's actually beyond our technology to grind that fine. So just because it's a resource doesn't mean we can access it. A mineral reserve is usually associated with a feasibility study of some kind, like a pre-feas. A mineral resource is an exploration outcome report where they don't know the true size or the true character of the resource. But the question is, if we did include all resources, are they useful? And it turns out, no, the quantity of metal is so large that mineral reserves plus resources is still not enough. And then there was a question, well, what about the seafloor? We haven't really done much with that. And so, well, yes, there's lots down there, but the resources that we know of, when you include them, is still not enough. So all the metals that we know on, like say for copper on planet Earth, is not enough, not even close to being enough, to manufacture the first generation of renewable technology to replace what we have to phase out fossil fuels now. Mining the seafloor, we shouldn't do that. The environmental impact would be disastrous. And so the outcome is we have got to, all right, all stop. Okay, we now need to be sensible about this and go back to the drawing board and have an honest and adult discussion about the challenges that we have and then what might we do about them.
Is there a single country that their grid could, like, take this? Are all the countries unprepared?
So every country has a list of pros and cons. Some things are good, some things are not good. For example, I'm in Finland, so we need electrical power to heat buildings to survive. Right, we don't need to do that in, say, New Guinea or in Africa. It's just not cold. So we've got major requirements for society to function that are energy-based. Right, so what I'm saying there is every nation state around us has different challenges. I would say all nation states at some level, at a policy preparedness, strategic policy development, like the people who plan for non-linear disaster events, you know, senior civil servants who they're not making open plans out of public space. But if, for example, Finland got hit with a disaster, what do we do? But those people, I think, are making plans because they understand quite well the predicament that we're in. But the outcomes of such a plans are very politically sensitive. No politician is going to get re-elected by bringing up these issues because no one wants to hear that the future will involve more work for less outcome. That's just the way we are. We don't look at these things.
Yeah. What about we have a lot of sustainability is a large trend, and we have a lot of like experts that are talking about promoting electricity. Is there things that you've seen that sustainability specialists haven't really realized? What should they focus on?
So what we call the sustainability experts is vulnerable to almost every other technical aspect, where we believe that I'm from the Australian mining industry, the commodities industry. We don't do much mining in Europe because we think it's, you know, beneath us. But we prefer to buy things, finished products off the market. Right. So the environmental activists trying to shut down a mine will quite happily buy a computer made in China with mineral resources extracted from Australia. Right. They don't see the hypocrisy in that at all. The commodities industry has been misunderstood, is what I'm getting at. We extract raw materials and we use them on a day-to-day basis all over the world, even here. So most people, for example, believe all innovations are market-driven. Price will go up, someone will think of something, and all commodities will magically appear. Now, that's the way things have been for the last century. We are now underpinned by the energy systems, oil in particular, cannot actually do that anymore.
So what can I do as a person, an individual, and what can I do if I was like a company? What should I focus on? Just go with the rules.
Okay, so this is actually quite a tough question, because to actually get any sort of action out of this at all, all the solutions involve a fundamental reconstruction of everything at such a fundamental level, we can't get our arms around this. So many things have to change at the same time. At an individual level, well, I suppose at both levels, the first step is to truly understand what we're looking at and the nature of what we're looking at. Most people don't want to do that because it's scary. So first is energy. Where do we get our energy from, and where do we get our raw materials from? And understand that the global just-in-time supply grid is now going to evolve into something else more regional. So we have to understand why that is. The answer to your question is understand and then build culture. That sounds very abstract. What do you mean? First of all, understand what you're looking at and understand that there are solutions if you choose to look at them. But those solutions are unorthodox and they've been previously rejected. Our energy systems have to evolve. That is clear. But to evolve into what? At the same time, our society has to contract its footprint in terms of how much raw materials it consumes, where it consumes them, how it consumes them, and what it does with the waste streams. So a fundamental reinvention. But energy is at the core. The one energy system I'm looking at that seems to be very interesting is liquid fuel fission. This is an evolution of the nuclear industry. The nuclear industry in its current form can't help us. It can't expand fast enough, and it's way too complex to be the primary energy system. And we don't have the technical capacity to manage such a large system in its current form. So if the nuclear industry was to evolve into something else, that might work. Liquid fuel means the fuel is liquid as it passes around the actual circuit, which means it takes a different form and it's run differently. The fuel I like to look at is thorium, because the front end and the back end of the nuclear fuel cycle is much smaller and has much less risk and is much easier to manage. But we could just as easily use uranium in liquid fuel, and there's some liquid metals that are actually possible as well. there's also the possibility of making smaller reactors. What that means is, instead of having like a massive, humongous nuclear reactor and then we send power out all over the countryside, every industrial site could have a small thorium burner under it, which means we dispense with the need of the transport grid, the grid between them. So not only do we not need the buffer, we've decentralized the power system and we've reduced our material consumption enormously by doing that one step. As it turns out, there's a group called Copenhagen Atomic that are actually seriously doing this. And so Sweden and Norway will probably lead the world in terms of these power systems that are being developed and are coming out. That will change things to the point where it's actually feasible and possible. So that's the first step. The second step is to look at this group's like the Club of Rome that's been trying to get us to look at the idea of degrowth. And no one wants to hear that because our current economic model is based on growth, profit, you know, and consumption and materialism, because it makes everyone rich and gives everyone a dopamine hit. All of it's going to be scrapped and replaced with something else. We have to make do with less. Life has to become simpler and we have to value things differently. So human society now needs a different relationship with the environment, with energy, and with resources. All of
sounds
it changes.
Impossible.
No, it's not. No, it's not. Because it sounds like a lot there, but what we're doing is making one change. One. And that change is, how does society see itself? And that one change has a knock-on effect to do everything else. And so that comes down to build culture.
But do we need everyone to make our goals true? Do we need all the countries?
Well, if we did all countries, then it'd be so much easier. But I don't know about you, but I found that you can't get agreement on any of this stuff at all. And so what I found is, instead of trying to put a solution on the ground for 8 billion people, we're going to fix it for everyone. What if we did things where, well, let's have a diversity of solutions. Everyone's got an idea, give it a go, and we'll see who prospers. So you start small. For example, can we do these solutions in a single town or in a single city? And everyone else will become very, very aware of what works and what doesn't. And if these ideas work and we tell everyone, lots of people will say, hey, that works. Because the existing system will break down and all existing plans in response will break down. And so we will see problem solving like you've never seen before, an innovation, and people will exchange information, what works and what doesn't. So no, we don't need everyone to agree, right? What we do need everyone is to see.
So how can we get people to start brainstorming the ideas?
Well, frankly, what you're doing now is actually very useful. What we're talking about is to get people to understand what they're looking at, get them to change their thinking. They will then find like-minded people, whether it's on the internet or in their own community, and they'll start to discuss things. And the more they discuss, the more doors that start to open, and they will realize they will need certain things, you know, whether it's information or whether it's actually equipment or access to certain people, they will go and find it. So this interview now, and things like it, like there's lots of things like it now on the internet now. This will actually then come to the point where it will set off a chain reaction.
So what about if I'm a company, I want to make a lot of money, I want to be sustainable also. Do you think that the companies that are really pursuing the sustainability goals will prosper the most into the future, that are open-minded?
Well, it depends on what they are. So what we call sustainability is doesn't include all the things that we need to include. Like in any of the sustainability goals, they have not linked at the heart of everything natural resources and where we get them from, or the embedded energy in getting those resources, or the complexity of manufacturing any of the stuff we use.
I don't need to be aware of that. Yeah. I have the EU regulations, and they say that this is zero emissions. So.
Sure. Great.
Why should I think differently?
Then when things don't work anymore, when things don't work, when the orthodox methods don't work, you either turn to the unorthodox or you accept failure. Mm. We are in a world at the moment where we can't discuss things openly, where things like the stove is hot. And we said, well, don't touch the stove then. But now we're in a world where that's fake news, or you know, the market told me different. All right, put your lower lip on the stove, tell me how it goes. That's now the environment we're in. We're going to learn the hard way. Now, so all these companies that are actually going after sustainability goals, I approve in what they're trying to do, but everyone I've come across so far is depending upon things that are not sustainable. Most of the green transition is dependent on fossil fuels to work, even after it's constructed.
So a lot of people will be really disagreeing with you.
Sure.
So could you give them a challenge to prove you wrong, or?
Okay. So yeah. So people disagree with me all the time, and that's okay. We've got to be in a world where people can express their opinions and people can disagree with them, and that's okay. Whereas at the moment, most discussions are very tribal and they're conquest-based. I've got to be right and you've got to be wrong, otherwise I can't sleep at night. That's not helpful. So I'm quite okay with if people disagree with me. I'm also okay if someone can prove me wrong, because then I'll sleep at night. See how that works? Right. So the challenges that I would give to them is, if you were to phase out fossil fuels completely, and I'm talking at a nation state level, how would you do that? How many physical units that are on the ground? This is for a complete replacement. How many electric cars are we talking about? How many trucks? What physical resources come into your country through shipping and through trucking and rail? And where's all this stuff come from? If you were to replace that with fossil fuels, how would you do it? How many? This is the question. How many such units are we talking about? And if you weren't to use fossil fuels anymore, how would you resource them another way? And then the question after that is, take all that all the way to natural resources, or where we got stuff from. Can you get that equation to balance? Because usually what happens is people say, oh, someone told me something different. That person says, oh, the market will sort it out, and that's all we need to know. So instead of actually abdicating responsibility to someone else does the thinking for us, what if we did the thinking ourselves? What would that look like? So here we are. Things like people who want to refute me, for example, on the size of the buffer for wind and solar. Can someone refute the fact that the sun in summer is indeed stronger than the sun in winter? Is that really the case? Or have I got that wrong? Asking for a friend.
Yes, pure silence on my behalf.
But there, so it's not to be rude, and I don't like this idea of aggressive debate. No, the ancient Greeks had the idea of in a debate, everyone who took part learned something. Mm. Whereas a debate at the moment is, I'm right, and I'm going to make you wrong, and I'm going to make you pay for being wrong in that discussion. That seems to be the modern world at the moment. We've got to get away from that, right? And so when I actually sort of put these ideas out there, there are responses and there are solutions to this, right? And so for example, people will often say, you're denying climate change. No. Or you're denying the green transition. And so, no, we need to do the green transition. And in fact, the only technologies we've got on the books at the moment are solar panels and wind turbines. Right, so we will do this. It's just going to be an entirely different proposition to what we think. And we'll very quickly have to evolve the system behind that as fast as we can.
So shortly, we need to be less egoistic. We need to be transparent. We need to be open-minded, talk with each other, give ideas.
Yeah.
And just be realistic about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So everything you just said in a nutshell is what we must do. Right. And why is that so hard to say that? Followed by, what we say and do has to be matched with reality. And that is not the case for most of what we're doing. So this is an environment for me personally that if someone was to prove me wrong, I'd be deliriously happy because the implications of the future world I would live in. So we are often encouraged to look at the challenge side of things. Society is doomed. We're done. We're finished. I like to think in other terms. There are solutions on the table that we can look at if we choose to. If we choose to. What I'm getting at is that we've got to look at this with open hearts and open minds with regards to problem solving, and we've got to understand that the person next to you is actually your solution, not your enemy. Don't get tied up in the despair. Look at the problem in terms of it's a problem to be solved, and while it's a big problem, it can be solved. And be the person having that idea. Don't wait for someone else to do it, because if we all do that, nothing happens. So look to the future with a more positive attitude, with the understanding of the challenges before us. We're not talking denial. Human innovation is a wonderful thing, but at the moment, we are refusing to do the thinking and we are abdicating responsibility to others in the hope it will work out. We've got to step up and take the challenge. That's what I would encourage people to think in terms of.
That sounded great. We need to lower our barriers and for the greater cause. So.
Yeah. It's almost like the same conversation of giving away power. By allowing someone else to speak and thinking about their ideas to change my opinions, I'm somehow ceding power to them. Are we? Well, we think we are. It's almost an allegory of Plato's cave. We've got to get out of Plato's cave and see things for ourselves.
Yeah, it's really hard because we just want to live day by day and we just think about tomorrow and somebody will take care of us.
Yeah, right? We've got to get out of that thinking for a start. We've got to take care of us or it don't happen, which is why we actually watch what everyone else is doing to see what works and what doesn't work and what can we learn from that.
Let's spread the love and keep being open-minded and really transparent. I just want to say deeply thank you for having this interview, Simon. This has been so eye-opening.
Okay. See you guys.
Bye.
That was Tony from Sustainable Logistics, thanking Simon Michaud for the conversation on Unveiling the Paradox, Extracting Non-Renewable Riches for a Sustainable Tomorrow. They spoke on April 7, 2024. You can find the 45-minute-long video on YouTube. His last name is spelled M-I-C-H-A-U-X. And you can find this program, as well as two others with Simon Michaud, on my website, tucradio.org. It's free. Pass on the links. Simon Michaud worked for the mining industry in Australia for 18 years. In 2015, he left to learn industrial recycling and the circular economy at the University of Leiden, Netherlands. Michaud is now associate professor at GTK, the Geological Survey of Finland. He works with governments, United Nations agencies, nonprofits, and financial institutions to help develop the renewable grid. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.